Oi, oi, it's your boy, the Misha Tate of Gamergate, Jack Slack, and it's the Jack Slack Serious Video Game Appreciation and Politics Podcast. No, I don't remember a thing about... I remember hearing about Gamergate and being like, all these people are trash. What am I supposed to think of this? And then I ignored it and apparently raged on for like another half decade and is still going. But the reason I open with that introduction is because, in addition to talking about Israel Adesanya versus Robert Whittaker 2 today and the other fights on that okay-looking card, I'm going to be talking about and largely hyping this game Sifu, which came out yesterday. I'd seen some stuff about it a couple of months before. I saw some stuff about it this week leading up to it, and all the reviews were good. And I was like, damn, indie martial arts game, beat 'em up with good reviews. Definitely have a look into that. So I hit the pre-order, watched the thing tick down on the old screen, started playing it as soon as possible. I think I got about 6 hours in now. I'm into the third level now. Yes, I finally beat the second level last night and arrived at level 3, age 77, which is not good. The way it works is the death mechanic, because it's a... I'm not going to say a Souls-like, a rogue-like or a rogue-lite. One of those things, but where you lose a lot of your progress when you die, or when you game over, rather, but there's also things that can be gained permanently, and by grinding those up, you can make it a lot easier for yourself going through again. And there's shortcuts to opening the levels and so on and so forth. But the way that death works in it is that you die and you can come back, but you get a death counter, and the magic talisman that brings you back to life... Each death you suffer adds a death to the death counter, and then every time you die, the total on the death counter is added to your age. So when you first die, it's like 20 to 21, and then you're 23, and it goes up like that. But by the time you've had a few deaths, suddenly you're like jumping from 59 to 71 or something like that. And after you hit 70, like, you don't get any more respawns, basically. So ending up at age 77 starting this new level was not ideal, and I just got killed by the first enemy because he had a knife, and no one up to that point had had a knife, and I'm blocking and he's chip damaging my arms. Real lesson about fighting there, though: don't fucking try and block knives. It's a terrible idea. Don't try and reach for knives or anything like that. Run from knives or grab a chair. Chair is great weapon. I was just watching that ridiculous Korean school zombie thing, but the one thing I did enjoy was that the guy pinned the zombie to the wall with a chair. I've seen people do that in actual knife attacks in CCTV footage and stuff. If you get a chair and you slam you can hold it by the legs and slam the seat into someone and push them back with that, or you can hold it by if it's got a substantial enough seat, you can hold it by the seat and jam the legs against the person to pin them against whatever. And if there's more than one of you, that's always good too. In fact, I saw a crazy one the other day. There was a machete attack in, I think it was Colombia, got filmed. And this lad, firstly, the dude who was swinging it didn't seem to be trying to kill anyone. He just seemed to be trying to, like, hack at people. In that, like, he's hitting people with the side of it. He's cutting people, but he's not, like, you know, laying into them properly. He just seemed like he was either drunk or having a mental breakdown or something like that. But this guy ducked and shot a takedown on him underneath the machete hand, and just double-legged him into death. It was phenomenal. And then the people around him pulled this guy off. They were like, leave him alone, he's just an old man with a machete. And the machete dude just wandered off. It was crazy. But anyway, Sifu, I died at the start of level 3, first knife encounter I had. But such a fun game, and really, like, beat-em-ups, and any sort of martial arts media, we've talked about this before, like, I don't want super realistic fighting. I don't want... streamlined MMA technique. I want people flailing their arms all over the place. I want the cool wushu movements and stuff. I don't want, like, wirework wuzia bollocks, but stylized is what we like. It's like all my favorite martial arts media is things like Prime Jackie Chan and Tony Jaa. Man, when Ong Bak came out, that blew people's minds. That was beautiful. And that was partly because he was, he had training with some old Muay Boran guy. And he trained Muay Thai, but I don't think he had any fights. But he had competed to a decent level as a gymnast. So it's kind of funny because it's basically the same story as Jim Carter, if you've ever seen that incredibly bad film. Or go watch The Come Town Lads, I think, spoke about it. Or Chapa Trap House, or someone did a big segment on it. I think Sean Baby wrote an article on it, actually. It cracked. But Jim Carter was... They got this guy who was the best pobble horse competitor in the world, and he just retired from professional competition or whatever. And they made this film, and they had the idea of the film. They had to get the conceit was, we're going to have a fight scene, but he's got to be near something that's pretty much a pommel horse. But yeah, no, apparently Tony Jaa was actually that. So yeah, stylized shit, and it's quite interesting because, like, when you play something like Dark Souls or any sort of Soulsborne title, there's a lot of sort of real martial arts know-how that can be brought in there. You know, one of the classics, and when you're getting into like martial arts in terms of like the military aspect of it, but one of the classics is like, don't let people surround you, try and line people up. And in the Souls games, that obviously works fantastically. You line people up in a corridor and you try and hack at them, and maybe you hit two of them with a swing and then you back off and you funnel them. But in martial arts media, and in this game, Sifu, it's cool to let people surround you and then just let them come in one at a time. Because if you're playing a third person, obviously, you can see everyone entering too. But it plays out better. You get more dodges and slips and parries in. You get more chances to hammer people with good counters. And, you know, it's a completely unrealistic style of fighting, but it plays out so entertainingly. And it's so fun to play too. Because I was playing through, like, the first few playthroughs, I unlocked the front snap kick, which is like a run-up front kick. And I was like, okay, cheesing it. At any time I met anyone difficult, I'd just move backwards through the level, draw them down, like, or draw them up a staircase or something like that, and just keep jumping over the front kick and then piecing out as soon as they tried to come back. I was like, this guy is everything I would be if this was me. And then, you know, as you get better at the game, you realize, oh, actually, no, it's to your benefit to get in there, have as many people as possible attacking you, mix it all up, getting off the slips and using focus. You know, you build up your focus by slipping and countering and parrying things. So, yeah, as someone who has completed a lot of Soulsborne titles, but has never been in love with them like a lot of people are, you know, I completed all the Dark Souls. Oh, no, I haven't done Dark Souls 1, actually. I completed Demon's Souls, Dark Souls 2, Dark Souls 3, a couple of the add-ons, gave up on Sekiro, which is the one that people are likening this most to. And Bloodborne, I've never been able to complete, but absolutely loved it, which is really annoying because I love the aesthetic and the lore and all that stuff, but I'm just crap at it. And I'm also like, I have specced this guy completely wrong, but I don't want to go back. It's like hours of gameplay I've put in. But yeah, Sifu, 10 on 10, brilliant game. We'll try and, I don't know, fucking stream it or just put up a YouTube video of me playing it or something like that at some point, because I'm having the time of my life playing it, and you should definitely get it too. And it's out on PS4, so, like, don't worry if you don't have a PS5, because I don't have a PS5. The list of people I'd need to blow to get a PS5 in the UK right now is far too long. One or two I'd manage, but, you know, when you're getting up into tens, nah. And then one of the other things I've been up to in the last week is watching ADCC, because it was the South American trials. I think they're doing two South American trials now, because as you would expect, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu still very big in Brazil. But the South American trials are just a killing floor, incredible number of elite grapplers down there. Like, Claudio Calasanz won the absolute, was it the absolute or his division, won it in 2015. Is now going out in the trials against kids down there. Just crazy. So it's always interesting because the North American, South American trials always contain people that you thought were one or the other anyway, or in the other place. It's like the European trials. It seems like a load of Brazilians come over to do those as well. It's like I knew someone who went to Oman to do the CrossFit trials there. It's like, well, that's a bit weird. But the thing with ADCC is that it's so many matches, especially the trials, the qualifiers, and, you know, there's no way to possibly watch all of it, but I have been watching a couple of the standouts. One of them was Mika Galvão, who has been on fire lately. I think he's 19, and he's just an incredible grappler. Really sort of interesting mix of, like, new school ideas and quite an old school game. did a lot of work from like Closed Guard, which it's really interesting. I was watching some Mastering the System with Eddie Bravo this week, and he was talking about how like you could win ADCC and never have to play Closed Guard. But if you go to MMA, you immediately have to play Closed Guard because that's just where you end up. But really interesting that Mikael Galvao was doing Closed Guard and using it well. Like he was using classical sort of half guard coming up on the underhook sweeps. He hit this amazing armbar. He came up on a half guard sort of like Lucas Leitch style sweep, or coming up into the dog fight is sometimes what they call it. And as his opponent was sort of like trying to come out onto his feet and get away, Mikael Galvao jumped over his back and armbarred him from this position that I could never see someone armbarring from before, and probably won't since, to be honest, or you know, in the future. I was just thinking, like, if I tried that, I would spike myself on my head really hard. But one of the other ones that stood out in the same division was a guy called Majid Haig, who has been around for a long time. Like, he was this young lad with dreadlocks back in the day, and he was famous for his baseball choke, which is a gi choke. It's where you put your hands inside the gi, so one hand is... like your right hand goes in on the right, on your right side of their head, and your left hand goes in on the left side of their head. One's pointing up, one's pointing down, and then there's no choke until you turn away from them, like belly down or to do a shoulder throw or whatever, and that pulls your elbows together and tightens the choke. So what he used to do was he'd put his grips in from somewhere like bottom side control, and then he'd turn away from his opponent like belly down and choke them out while like showing them his back. It was a crazy choke, and he caught a load of good guys like Clark Gracie, he choked unconscious with it. But it's interesting because I knew him as a gi guy. I knew him as sort of like a gimmicky gi guy. And he turned up for this Abu Dhabi trials. And he's got to be like 30-something, nearing 40 now, probably. But he turned up in shorts with pockets, a baggy T-shirt that he tucked into his shorts so he looked even more like an old man, and then knee straps on both sides. You know, this dude... I guarantee you he could get a sponsored rash guard. He could get someone to sponsor him and give him cool kit. And he just turned up looking old school anyway, like the old Eddie Bravo back in the day, wearing shorts and no shirt. And to his credit, he had five matches that day. Oh no, he got five matches to get to the final, and he submitted every single person. And he submitted a lot of them very quickly. Did a lot of arm crunch stuff, you know, that sort of like on the shoulder arm bar that plays in with like the shoulder crunch sweep that Gordon Ryan does. Did some really good guard passing. I noticed this year, number of dudes, like Majid Haig had a match, but there's been a couple where one guy will be on top and he'll lead with his left foot. And you go, ooh, that's unusual. And then he'll get swept and the other guy who just swept him will lead with his left foot. Because everyone, almost everyone, learns to pass with their right foot forward. And then because they've got so many reps invested in that, they never change. So they go, oh, well, you know, everyone says, like, if I started again, I'd learn to pass better on my left, with my left foot forward. But no one ever, like, commits to doing that because they get so good passing with their right leg forward that they're like, well, if I go back to zero, you know, what have I learned? But then Majid Haig met Mikael Galvao in the final, and Galvao submitted him with a triangle. Off a really nice high crotch to get the fight to the mat by Haig. So, yeah, that was really exciting. I haven't watched all the divisions, but that one was really good. I think that was under 77, maybe under... No, he only goes down to under 66, so I think that's under 77 kilos. But we're getting there. We're going to have an ADCC soon, which is my favourite time of... I was going to say year, but like favourite time of 2 years. And for this one, it's going to be like 3 years. Right then, we've got... some fights coming up this weekend at UFC 270. So let's have a little bit of chatter about them. I mean, the main event is Bobby Knuckles versus Israel Adesanya 2. Positions reversed. Whittaker is no longer the champion. Adesanya is the champion because he won it off Whittaker last time. And it's been an interesting couple of years since their last fight. Israel Adesanya was obviously being heralded as like the greatest star in the UFC. At the moment, they booked him into a second title fight at light heavyweight. And, you know, up until Jan Blachowicz won, pretty much everyone was treating that as a cakewalk. Which isn't to say, like, you know, people were underestimating Jan Blachowicz. People just thought that Israel Adesanya had been that good. There's been a couple of weaker performances from Adesanya in the time since the first Whittaker fight. Most notably, probably the Yoel Romero one, which everyone was very unhappy about. A fight where not a lot happened, but also Romero, in a fight where almost nothing happened, Romero did enough that some people felt that he deserved the win. Then the Blachowicz loss and the Marvin Vettori fight, which was uneventful, but not through any fault of Adesanya's, I don't think. Marvin Vettori came in with a game plan that he stuck to religiously, and his corner had no intention of changing, even as it became clear that it wasn't enough. But there was the Paulo Costa win in there, which was absolute domination of a very strong contender. And in the meantime, Robert Whittaker has been on a great little run. Beat Darren Till, beat Jared Cannonier, beat Kelvin Gastelum. I suppose, yeah, one of the interesting things about that is that those guys are all three of them strikers. All three of them nowhere near the technician that Izzy is on the feet. Don't offer the same problems that Whittaker was having in the first fight. Well, I suppose there aren't that many good wrestlers in the middleweight division at the moment. You got Brunson, who's on the undercard, sorry, the main card of this fight. And I don't know, Hermanson, but Hermanson couldn't even get Strickland off his feet. But for Whittaker, it's been an interesting couple of years. Where was the first fight? 2019, end of 2019. So it's been an interesting few years. He's looked really, really good. He's had some shakier moments. The Jared Cannonier fight, he got hurt a couple of times. Right at the end of that fight, I think he got dinged quite hard and it was going badly. But, you know, you're fighting a 25-minute fight. It doesn't matter what would have happened if the fight continued. As Nate Diaz's career, or that Leon Edwards fight certainly proves. However, his most recent one against Kelvin Gastelum was absolutely sensational. And it really just like, and the interesting thing is that that was going to be a title fight at one point. They did a series of tough where they were both coaches. But I think some of the stuff that Whittaker's shown, like more level changes, more wrestling, not an awful lot, but more of it has been good. But if anything, these three fights have just confirmed that he's a very, very fast man, which we already knew, but he's still fighting out in the open. He's not making use of the cage. He's not fighting. None of the things that he's shown really feel like they would apply to the problems that Adesanya was giving him in the first fight. I think the thing about Whittaker is that, like, he apparently he comes from a Hapkido background, but he has that sort of get in, land one shot, and get out style that is very prevalent in, like, point fighters or people who come from point fighting competition backgrounds. So he's very, very quick covering the distance. And if you watch the very first fight between, I say very first, the only fight between Adesanya and Whittaker to this point, the thing that really stands out is that Adesanya makes a lot of distance going backwards, and he cuts cool angles off that too. So he'll lean back and step his rear foot back so that he can lean really far, and then he'll step his lead foot back behind him while leaning, and he'll often do that off to his side as well. So he makes an awful lot of distance going back, and is obviously helped by the fact that he's very tall and that he leans back onto his back leg and away from his away from the opponent. So that first fight was really weird because Whittaker was chasing him. And Whittaker would sometimes get to him and you would go, oh, damn, Whittaker really does cover a lot of ground. But it was taking a lot of effort to get in with a good jab or something like that. And a lot of commitment as well. If you watch that first Whittaker fight, because one of the things that I used to say when Whittaker was coming up was that he's this really weird mix of very slick technical striker, like about 70% slick technical striker, and then 30% just getting redacted in there, just being silly. You know, he'll throw lovely jabs and lovely step up low kicks and things like that, or bounce into like a side kick to the knee, and then he'll just lean his head out ahead of him and swing a right hand. Like the Whittaker Brunson fight is a great example of Brunson just being an absolute madman, and he's running towards Whittaker with his head like almost level with his hips because it's so far forward of his hips. And then you watch Whittaker's fights and he does that as well. He just does it. He doesn't do it all the time, and he puts it in between striking really well. And sometimes he like cracks people with getting wild. with these big weird shots. And that's something that I've been writing about in this Advanced Striker 2.0, Alexander Volkanovsky. You know, technical striking benefits from your willingness to bite down on your mouthpiece and just swing. The more you're happy to just crack and fight with people, the more your feints become real, because they know that you're happy to just fight. So you benefit more from the technical side of striking if you're happy to have a brawl anyway. Whereas if you're very clearly coming in there and you're like, I'm going to feint and build and I don't really want to get into exchanges, they know, and they're just going to stop responding to your feints. So Whittaker's weird swinging helps his feinting, helps his more technical game, and then his more technical game helps his weird swinging. But if you watch that first Adesanya fight, he's getting so overcommitted. Like, he's running in with his chin out. And Israel Adesanya did not finish a lot of people with, like, great counter work. You know, he's not really... While he's a good counter fighter, most of his work has been done with volume and leading and, you know, ones and twos. He never throws long combinations, but he does throw an awful lot of strikes over the course of a fight. But he's very much a guy on the lead for the most part. And Whittaker is just running at him and pursuing him. You know, if you watch, say, the first Vettori fight, Adesanya will land a good poking strike or whatever, and then he'll lean back as Vettori returns, and then he'll step out the side door. And Vettori stops, because he's not going to chase him once he realizes that, like, the first punch or the first two punches haven't hit. Whereas Whittaker is, like, running to try and get to Adesanya. So I know that I'd listened to the Heavy Hands boys earlier today, and I know that they're giving Rob credit for landing some good jabs and things like that. And I do remember in that first fight being like, oh man, Rob really does cover distance well. But also, like, why is he, I mean, why are you still trying to chase this man down the train tracks? Everything, I mean, there's a lot of things that Rob Whittaker can do to make his chances in this fight better and to make it more of a fight. I feel like, you know, saying that their styles are just matched up so that Rob will always get smoked or whatever is really reductive sort of thinking. I saw someone saying, like, a Tai Tuivasa versus Lewis is an interesting match, at least, whereas Adesanya versus Whittaker is not. And you're like, what? Rob Whittaker has so many skills that it is really just how he fights that is going to affect this fight. It's not like, I know that people are, and this is going to be, like, reflective on Adesanya too. It's the decisions they make and how they fight tactically within this fight that matter. It's not like nothing, they can both fight however they want and Rob Whittaker will lose. Like, that's such a weird way to look at things. I mean, you know, if you look at fights like that, you'll constantly be surprised and impressed. But that's not how fighting works when you've got two really elite guys in there. And these two are so much better than the rest of the division for the most part that, you know, the decisions will matter. And chasing after Israel Adesanya with your chin out is a really bad decision for a good technical fighter like Rob Whittaker and a good rounded fighter. We talked a lot before about, like, when Israel Adesanya moves back, there is a degree of moving back on a line, and then he does cut off the line when he takes the step, when he breaks his stance and goes to a different stance, retreating backwards. Or you know, shifting back. So he goes from orthodox to southpaw, or southpaw to orthodox. That's when he takes a step off line. But first he goes back, and he makes good distance going back. And the thing with that is, like, there's two ways to attack that. One is to use the movement to get him somewhere where he's going to struggle to use the movement the next time. You know, you use one failed attempt to get in, or quote-unquote failed, because if you're treating it like you want to get towards the fence anyway, then no attack has failed if the guy moves. And then the other one is to hammer the leg, because he leans back at the waist and he leaves. There's always going to be one leg behind. The last thing to leave range is always the trailing leg. And you saw that in the first fight. There are a couple of instances, I think it's three or four times, Whittaker, like, lunges at him and then he steps up into a low kick as Izzy's backing off and leaning back, and he hammers the leg for free. And when I say that, like, that's not an answer to, like, the whole fight, but what you're doing then is you're taking away his, like, where in that first fight, all Izzy had to do every time Rob came in was move back and lean and then cut off the angle. When you add the low kick, you add a choice. There's something that the opponent has to choose one or the other. And that's how you can build effective striking. Because if even if you're in with a much better striker, if you give them something where they have to make a choice between check or, you know, withdraw the leg, but then your head's staying in range, or rather you have to stop retreating, or pull away, continue doing that, you're giving yourself like a 50-50 chance of actually connecting each time. You know, it's not like a clever setup. You're not tricking anyone, but you are bringing yourself into the fight by just saying, like, you know, I'm going to do one of two things. You had to pick which one you're going to deal with. And, even a bad outcome is like you land 25% of the time. Or you get a chance 25% of the time. And the other thing about, like, catching the leg with the low kick as he's retreating is that it picks up the leg, it knocks it off course, and you get a chance to follow up in. But then the important point of that is always, like, I feel everyone against Israel Adesanya should be looking to use the fence. There is a huge caveat there, because Marvin Vettori fought him last time trying to use the fence, but in an especially silly way. Israel Adesanya is really good at using the fence to hold himself up. But having the fence at his back will cut off a lot of his movement out in the center of the cage. So you have to say, when I get him to the fence, that's when I'm doing my striking. Not double jabbing back, which is what Marvin Vettori did. The double jab will work against Israel Adesanya because it's volume in the air. Like, if it hits him, great. If he stays still, great, follow with the right hand. But if he moves, you've got a weapon that's moving him back and you have control of some sort on this very elite striker who you've been having trouble doing anything to. So if you have that little bit of control and you can double jab and he'll move back, you can start moving him towards the fence and cutting off his ability to move back. But then if you just drop on the hips every time, as Marvin was doing, like, even in round five, or going into round five, Rafael Caldera is like, yes, double jab and then shoot on his hips. And you're like, okay. No, he's just using the fence to hold himself up. Why are you dropping on his hips on the fence every time? When you get a good mover to the fence, firstly, like, you can't treat it as the chance to take their head off, which I feel like a lot of people also do if they get Israel Adesanya or another great mover to the fence, they go like, now's my chance. You've got to use it as a chance to, because the head still moves. If you watch Israel Adesanya when he gets, I was going to say cornered, but the corners aren't severe enough in the cage. But there's been like moments when he's been along the fence and he's not wanted to be there, because it's not like, even though he works on it a lot, like, I think if you name search me on Twitter, one of the top ones there, because he's so popular, is Israel Adesanya talking about me and Lawrence Kenshin, and talking about how he's drilling his ring craft and how hard he's working on, like, staying out of corners and things. But, it still happens from time to time in fights, even to the elite of the elite, and then you have to get out, and that's when you do your direction change. You hip fake, and you direction change. You go left, you go right, you go left again. Or, you know, you go left, they swing, you duck under and go out the side. You know, it's all about drawing that big swing to the head, and you've seen Israel Adesanya do it. I think he did it against Paulo Costa. Might have done it against Yan, but Izzy's great at it. Dom Cruz is great at it, you know, where they get you to the fence and you go, you want to play into that. You know, you want to get off the fence as soon as possible, but you also want them to swing as soon as possible because they'll fuck their chance up if they do that. Whereas if you watch, like, Dom Cruz versus Henry Cejudo is a great example, but, like, when you put someone near the fence and they start circling side to side, they flatten out their stance to necessitate side to side movement. So rather than standing with 1 foot forward and 1 foot back, they start standing sort of like, feet level, you know, side skipping. And that's your opportunity to get to the legs, because the legs are now on a small strip of ground between you and the fence. They're not going to move. And to get his leg up and over the kick is very hard. To check while you're stepping side to side is very hard. If you kick and they do check, you're on top of them swinging at them. So that's the really good time to start kicking the legs. Back people on the fence, kick them in the legs. It worked against Demetrius Johnson for both Henry Cejudo and Wilson Hayes, got it by accident at a couple of points. But then Henry Cejudo got good and did it against Dom Cruz, most notably. And Cruz was so lost that he was like trying to jump two-footed over the kick each time, because there wasn't really anywhere he could go with his legs. He couldn't do anything else because he's on train tracks around the cage. And linked to that is the body shot. Like, that's the classical boxing way of dealing with it. You know, if you watch Sandy Sadler versus Willie Pep, it's a great example. Pep ducks under every swing that Sadler takes at him along the ropes. So Sadler starts digging to the body instead. And you can't duck a body shot. I mean, you can, but you'd have to get, like, on the floor. And those are things that play into the fight long term. Because, like, if you can do that several times, you can start setting up shots upstairs. I really like the right straight to the body of Izzy along the fence. And I really like it for Rob Whittaker here because he has such a great left hook. He can use that to set it up. Also, if you watch, like, the second fight with Alex Pereira, I don't put too much stock in the Pereira wins because, firstly, the first fight he didn't win. But, secondly, you know, it was just a big connection in the second fight. But how he caught him was, like, his head came in. He looked at Adesanya's body. Adesanya just happened to be too close with his hands down. He got cracked with, I think it was an overhand right and then a left hook to follow up. But, like, if you keep going to the body and the legs, you give yourself the chance that you can level change, look down and throw an overhand or hit him with the right straight to the body and come up with the left hook. I think that's how, if you want to be swinging at Israel Adesanya's head, that's how you want to do it. But you want to set it up with good ring craft, good footwork, good encouragement of getting him to the fence, you know? He's a good hitter. He's not like a death touch hitter. I feel like if Rob stays in his stance, you know, even if he stands there and gets sharpshooted the entire night, I feel like he can take those a lot better than if he's lunging after Adesanya and just feeding him easy check hooks. So it's a case of, like, keep yourself safe, stay over your feet and double jab your way in or jab an inside low kick your way in, just or pick up the lead leg and drift in behind it like you're faking a teep. Those movements that chew up distance, those are what people need to be doing against Israel Adesanya. And Marvin Vettori has shown that that will work in that context. But if you then do something retarded after it, like you've done the hard work and then you're doing something stupid afterwards, and I worry that, like, teams will look at that and go, well, now that means the double jab doesn't work. You know, because, like, everything else being set aside, if we consider Israel Adesanya's excellence in MMA, a lot of it can be, everything everyone does in MMA is affected by having a fence there, whether it's wrestling, striking, whatever. And more you're seeing, like, the need to be able to control where the fight happens. And I think this links in really well with the wrestling too, because Adesanya's wrestling really is very strong when he's against the fence. And if you watch Marvin Vettori, like, so much of that fight was wasted on, like, trying to drop on doubles and pull his legs out on the fence, where if you succeed, he's going to be sat against the fence, which is, like, position one of building up. Whereas if you watch, like, the modern cage wrestlers nowadays, a lot of it is upper body control, double underhooks, and then step inside. I mean, we talked about this with Shavkat earlier in the week, but step your knee inside and you try and hit the throw, turning them off the fence so that they land on their back, facing away from the fence. Because then they've got the hard work of, like, it's not even that they're too far away from the fence, but they're also facing the wrong direction. They've got to somehow turn themselves around to get to the nearest fence to put their back on it. And there are guys who excel holding guys down against the fence, and there are guys who excel holding guys down away from the fence. I think you have to look at it and say, Israel Adesanya, he's been good off his back in the center of the cage, but he's been better stopping takedowns and building back up along the fence. So if you're going to wrestle him, body lock, turn him off the fence. Don't fuck around for ages on single legs and double legs and dropping on his hips and just being pulled up again. Because he just stands there in that position with, like, his hands under your armpits or looking like he's trying to pull his pants up. It's no biggie. And the other thing about, like, lower body attacks along the fence is that you can't strike off it. If you're in an upper body clinch, at least you can land some knees and things and add a little bit to your attrition game. But I think the real concern for me coming into this one is that I don't think Rob Whittaker is a ring craft focused fighter at all. I think he's much better in, like, a point sparring sort of fencing match. He's absurdly quick. If you watch him against Kelvin Gastelum, because Kelvin Gastelum's very quick but fades through the rounds. And even from round one, Whittaker's able to tee off him on him. And by the end of the fight, he's able to land his 1-2 and then wait for Gastelum's return and hit him with a check hook and a counter right hand as well. Cannoneer, another example. But, like, these are guys who are not the same level of movers that Adesanya is. For Adesanya, I think, you know, firstly, if you can irritate him enough, like pulling away from exchanges as you did in the first, yeah, he'll run himself onto something. But stay off the fence, obviously, unless he's operating a wrestling-heavy game plan, then try and stay on the fence when he's wrestling. Look for intercepting knees and uppercuts to scare him out of the takedown attempts or level change takedown attempts. And I think hammer him with kicks at long range, because that's something that, like, in the last few especially, you know, he's been dealing with scary punches and fast dudes, but no one kicking as regularly and as effectively as Israel Adesanya does. The front kicks to the body, you know, Whittaker is a very well-conditioned athlete, but front kicks to the body into those question mark kicks to the head, the low kicks, the calf kick, all that stuff is going to irritate and hurt him and all serve to encourage him to enter in ways that are not advantageous to him. You know, you want him charging in and trying to hit you as opposed to building towards the fence. The more this fight is one exchange at a time, the more I think Israel Adesanya wins it. But I'm very intrigued because they're two very skilled fighters with skills in different sort of areas, but you know, just so much better than the rest of the division for the most part. Actually, one of the interesting things about the if the match does hit the mat, you've been seeing moments of real awareness from Whittaker in these last three fights. I mean, he could have been building up towards Adesanya with Adesanya always in mind, but if you watch the one I'm always talking about is the Gastelum one where he takes Gastelum down and he's in half guard and Gastelum gives up underhook, cross face, everything you need to pass. But Whittaker's not taking it. He's staying in half guard because he knows that Gastelum is going to roll to his hands and knees and get up. And Izzy, while he's not like the same sort of traditional folk-style-y wrestler that Gastelum is, he's quite similar. Like he'll throw up triangles and things like that to roll out and get back to his feet. Kind of like Charles Oliveira. He's more interested in activity than holding you in his guard and staying safe. Whereas that Whittaker-Gastelum fight showed that Whittaker will pass up the better position in the hierarchy for keeping in control and staying on top. So that's quite encouraging if the fight hits the mat, but it's obviously going to be a lot of work to get Israel Adesanya off his feet. I could see a takedown working more if he's able to actually get the fight towards the fence and land some good shots or draw Izzy onto the lead and work on the counter effectively, which is something that I haven't really considered. I don't think that's a great path to victory for him. But you know what I'm saying? Like, if he's able to start landing successfully, then he can distract Israel Adesanya and hopefully time a good takedown out in the open, like a level change. But yeah, I mean, playing it out in my head, I'm seeing Whittaker getting into like one exchange at a time and getting ahead of himself and struggling with a man who like maybe isn't faster in a straight across the cage race, but is good enough at pulling away and cutting off the angles, cutting off the line of attack and making it hard to hit him, that Whittaker will get incredibly frustrated and fight the same silly fight that he did in the first. But anyway, like I've talked about that one to death. I've been hyping that up for like the last 2 years, saying like, well, you know, I did not like the way Whittaker fought in that first fight, but I suppose we'll see. And hopefully, I mean, yeah, I listened to the Heavy Hands boys earlier today and they said like, you should be rooting for a longer fight in this one because you want as much of these guys in the cage together as possible. And I'm very much there. Right. What else is going on this card? Derek Lewis versus Tai Tuivasa. This one, like, Tai Tuivasa, I was quite hot on when he came into the UFC. I think I called, it was like The Fight's Gone By podcast episode 11 or something like that, but I think I called it like Mark Hunt 2.0 question mark. And I really did enjoy his first fight in the UFC. There was a lot of classic Hunt in there. The right elbow, the right low kick, when guys clinched him, he'd use both hands underneath the chin, push the chin up, and then dig his head in and then get underhooks. Or if he had underhooks, he'd push the guy to the fence, put his head under their chin, then transition to hands under the chin and back out, basically. Like, if you put your hands underneath someone's chin and bench press or, you know, overhead press, whatever, whichever angle it is, like forwards and up. But if you just press their face away, it makes it very hard for them to hold on to you. And it's not like wrestling. You won't see it in wrestling, typically, to be fair, but it's kind of like, I mean, it appears in the Babishi. That's how old that technique is. But like hands under the jaw and push away is a great way out of a clinch. And Tuivasa and Hunt both did that. You know, Hunt had a real like reinvention of himself. I think he went to American Top Team. But like around about the time that he fought Czech Congo, things just started coming together. Like he used to be a guy who just couldn't wrestle, couldn't deal with anything else. And then, I mean, he did out-grapple Fedor, which is crazy. Fedor came in, like, no shape to fight. But around about the time of the Czech-Congo fight, Hunt starts putting together this quite simple but very effective takedown defense where, like, he gets an underhook and he turns the opponent onto the fence, posts his head underneath their chin and pushes off their face. And Tio Vasa was doing that from fight one in the UFC. The Hunt-Lewis fight is great as an example of Hunt fighting clever. Like that and the Roy Nelson fight are really good examples of like him growing as a fighter and just getting to be like a wily old vet. Because he'd been knocked out before at that point. He couldn't rely on being just made of titanium as he did against like Jerome Labanna and Ray Seifo. But he was good enough as a striker that he could use shoulder feints. He could get the guy swinging at air, hit him while he's ducking and stuff like that. If you watch that Lewis fight, Hunt's showing tons of shoulder feints, like the odd inside low kick, just stuff that you don't associate with Hunt because it's quite non-committal. It's not a leaping left hook into a right straight, you know? And he's backing Lewis up, and you're just watching Lewis freak out. He hates being made to work. What he likes is to be left alone until he wants to spaz out and knock you out. But in that Hunt fight, Hunt just backs him onto the fence, and every time Hunt steps in, Lewis loads up a big swing, and then Hunt will step back, and Lewis will either swing at air, or he'll just stop the swing and look really dejected and take a big breath. The more you, like, because his answer to being backed up to the fence is, oh, I've got to swing my way out of this. So if you put him on the fence and you keep trying to step in, or showing the step in, he's going to swing at air until he stops, and then you can step in and hit him. And it's that fine line, you've got to make him believe it, you've got to be able to hit him. But the low kick, the right low kick, Derek Lewis has no answers for it. Stands almost lock-legged. JDS pounded him in. Cyril Garn pounded him in. Cyril Garn fought southpaw for most of the fight until he realized that if he went orthodox, he could just get a free low kick and like run up into it. And those ones really hurt Lewis and began the beginning of the end. The thing is that Tai Tuivasa is not Mark Hunt. And Mark Hunt was a much better fighter than him. I mean, the interesting thing is that Tai Tuivasa was in Mark Hunt's corner and you can hear him shouting in through the fight. He's there with like a backwards beanie on. But I don't know how much I believe that Tai Tuivasa can stay on plan. Because Derek Lewis will swing back and Mark Hunt did get hit. And what he'd do is he'd take a step back, blow a grab out of his nose. He'll be like, ugh. And then step back in because he's Mark Hunt. Like even if his chin wasn't what it used to be, he can still take a fantastic shot and come back. He never had to like worry about it. Whereas Tai Tuivasa, I don't know, because I've seen him get knocked out by like Junior Dos Santos. I mean, both these guys fought Dos Santos when he was an old man. And both of them crumbled about minute seven of the fight. Because that's just standard heavyweight, you know. If you get that far into the fight, you're going like, oh no, what if I lose this one? What, I haven't been able to knock him out yet. So really, like, looking at this stylistically, Tai Tuivasa has like the couple of weapons he needs to beat Derek Lewis. And he has a decent chin. But Tai Tuivasa also keeps blowing fights against half-decent over-the-hill heavyweights. So, crap fight. Afterwards, Tai Tuivasa said he's going to drink a shui out of Derek Lewis's cup because it is a really weird sexual thing for him. And then let's move on. We've got Jared Cannonier versus Derek Brunson. Fun fight. I mean, Cannonier is still sort of a question mark in the wrestling. I think Whittaker got him down, but over the course of like a 25-minute fight. I seem to remember him doing well against Gastelum in the wrestling. That Gastelum fight was really fun. I was very impressed with Cannonier in that. He was switching to southpaw and landing some really good right hooks against the fellow southpaw. So he was switching into a closed guard, whereas most people, if they switch into an open guard or switch to get onto an open stance. Meanwhile, Brunson like had a great career resurgence. Like he looked better than ever against Edmund Shabazian. And then his most recent fight just looked like the same old Brunson again. But still the only like really strong wrestler at middleweight going. And Cannonier's most famous like performance against a wrestler was Dave Branch and Jack Hermanson, both of whom tried a takedown, freaked out when they couldn't get it immediately, stood back and awkwardly struck for the rest of the round, and then tried another takedown at the start of round two and got uppercutted and finished. Both of them. So, it's a case of whether Brunson can hang on the feet long enough to get the takedowns and whether Cannonier can stop him from getting the takedowns as the fight progresses or smoke him early. I think for Brunson, you got to switch on to open stance because he can fight from both stances like as well as he can fight from his main stances is what I'd say. Like, it's not great, but just hammer in the high kick on the open side is what I'd say for him because it's such a great setup to the takedown. It's a Colby Covington one, but I've seen Brunson use it against Shabazian. If you hammer in the high kick on the open side, you stand the guy up and you move his hands away from his hips. Because one of the dangers of fighting like a guy like Cannoneer, who is, his things are that he's very powerful and he's very strong, as in powerful hitter, strong wrestler, in terms of strength, not like a great technical wrestler. He's not Jose Aldo, like using his footwork, or Dominic Cruz using his footwork to deny takedown attempts. His answer is always, as they shoot in, dig the underhooks, pull your pants up. Second black person on the card I've told to pull their pants up. I'm turning into Bill Cosby. But you know what I mean, like that digging in the underhooks under the armpits. Mirko Krokop used to do it a lot too, but it's a really old school sort of sprawl and brawl strategy. And one of the ways that you can make that harder is that you throw high kicks to get their hands upstairs. If their hands are up, they have to come down to get to their hips and dig underhooks. So high kick, level change, high kick, left straight, high kick, level change, high kick, left straight. Great little sequence for wrestlers. If he can do that over and over again, he can get away, hopefully, scot-free. If he dives onto an uppercut, more fool him. For Cannoneer, his hands have always been great, but I'd love to see him hit the body in this one, try and take it out of Brunson and encourage more reckless level changes, more reckless chasing after takedowns. You know, think Brunson versus Whittaker, Brunson versus Adesanya. Once he's struggled a little bit and been popped, he gets really reckless and sort of runs after people. What else is good on this card? I'm going to like whistle stop this because these aren't amazing fights. Kyla Phillips is back. They put him against Marcelo Rojo. I think Rojo's lost a couple now. And Phillips is, he's only lost the one against Piva, but Piva really just toughed it out in that one. That was more Kyla Phillips fighting silly than it was Roland Piva being an amazing fighter. But, you know, he got that decision over Song Yadong back in March 2021 and was looking great in that. Very talented guy, whereas Rojo is... I thought there would be a cancelled fight because the ranking difference between these guys, I mean, at least on Tapology, Kyla Phillips is in the top 20 worldwide. And Marcelo Rojo is 124. To be fair, Phillips is ranked at bantamweight and Rojo is ranked at featherweight, but this fight is at bantamweight. But Rojo just most recently got knocked out by Charles Jourdain back in March 2021, same time that Phillips was beaten Yadong, and then he's had a load of cancelled fights since then. I mean, this looks like a sort of get back on. I mean, John Castaneda also arm triangled him. Man, just John Castaneda making the arm triangle his technique. But, you know, it's a couple of times in recent memory that Rojo's been finished. This looks like a bit of a tune-up for Phillips. Nasrat Haqparast versus Bobby Green. Great fight. Love it. Haqparast, I think there's a chance that it all depends if Bobby Green's actually going to counter off this shoulder roll, because Haqparast leans so far forward when he throws his right hand. He throws his left. What is he, a southpaw? Can't remember. He throws his rear hand as an overhand and he drops his lead hand and leans like his head past his lead foot toes. It's incredible. But also, you know, Dan Hooker out wrestled him. So if Bobby Green mixes the level changes well with the boxing, I could see that giving Haqparast a nightmare. Haqparast is very powerful though for his weight. Don't even have to say that anymore now because everyone at bantamweight up just cracks. Andrei Arlovsky versus someone I've never heard of. Roxanne Modafferi's retirement fight. I swear she's had a retirement fight already, but she's fighting Casey O'Neill. Casey O'Neill from Scotland. She's very... people are very hot on her at the moment. This is the classic sort of like Roxanne Modafferi against a good up-and-comer could totally spoil it for her. And those are always worth watching. Alex Perez is back versus Matt Schnell. I believe Alex Perez hasn't fought since he was the headliner on a pay-per-view and now he's in the prelims. Matt Schnell's always fun. William Knight is against Maxim Grishin. Yep, gonna bang. Hernandez versus Moicano sounds fun. I hope Moicano can get back on track there. Hernandez, really, like, if people lose to him, it's because they haven't studied the fucking tape and don't know what he does. Like, because it's side-to-side movement and then always on the straight line. Donald Cerrone tore him apart with intercepting knees because Hernandez will just run in and reach for you. Work on the intercepting counters and you give him a very hard time. But if Renato Moicano comes out and he's trying to like low kick him while Hernandez is bouncing out of range, I could see him fucking that up and getting caught with a counter on one leg. And then I suppose the last one I know is Douglas Silva, Deondrage versus Sergey Murazov. That'll be fun. And then Jeremiah Wells, who's 9-2, he was booked to fight Jake Matthews, and that was cancelled. And then he was booked to fight Tim Means as a replacement, and then Tim Means had to withdraw. So he's ended up against some poor lad who's 3-0, who's had his call up to the UFC to go and fight a guy who's not really known, but decent enough to have smoked like Wally Alves, to have been booked against Miguel Baeza and Jake Matthews and Tim Means. So that's a real rough one to come in at like 3-0 and have to fight that. But anyway, that'll do us for today. I'm going to be back on Monday talking about the fights as they happened. And you know where to find all my stuff. I am your boy, Jack Slack. Jared Cannonier's Crystal Energy and QAnon Beliefs. Bless.